I am delighted to introduce to you our speaker, Hala Ibrahim, who is this year a visiting lecturer on women's studies and Islamic law at Harvard Divinity School, and is a fellow of both the Human Rights Program and the Islamic Legal Studies Program at Harvard. Working as a lead attorney with a team devoted to the cause of human rights for women in Nigeria, she's won a number of precedent-setting cases before Islamic Sharia courts. In 2005, she was awarded the Sakharov Prize for Freedom of Thought by the European Parliament, which honors individuals or organizations for efforts on behalf of human rights and freedoms. She was cited for her work as defense counsel in approximately 50 cases brought under the aegis of Sharia law, many of which involved women sentenced to death by stoning. Professor Ibrahim earned an LLB and a Master's in International Law and Diplomacy from the University of Jos in Nigeria, a BL for Legal Practice from Nigeria Law School, and Master of Law in International Studies at American University's Washington College of Law. And we're just so delighted to have you here today to speak to us about the status of women in Nigerian society today. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me. I'm looking around the room. I'm really honored to be here. And I apologize for walking in a bit late. Sincerely, from my culture, that is not right. I can't keep you waiting. Let me start by saying that the campus is so beautiful. When I was driving in, I saw it's really, really gorgeous and beautiful. But more, I think Eric has been one of the fascinating human beings I have met. He is so persistent and to getting things done. And I'm so glad that I know you. You teach me a lot by what you do. English is my fifth language. So if you don't understand what I'm saying, just wave at me. I'll repeat so that we can communicate. The group is not big, and I want it to be discussion-based. Let us talk about things that we want to talk about. I'll introduce, broadly speaking, where I'm coming from, what I have done, and I'll also introduce the topic, which are some of the challenges working on the field. I'll just introduce them, and I'll open up so that we could have a discussion. I understand it's 1 hour. I am a field person. I'm a hands-on person. I've practiced law for 22 years. I practiced first as a prosecutor. And as a prosecutor, I did prosecute for 8 years. So that's my background. I did a little bit of work in the police before I became a prosecutor. I then defended cases for the past 10 years before I came to Radcliffe in 2008. I was defending cases in Sharia court, which is the Islamic court. That one, if you ask any question about it, I can answer you. I am not an Islamic scholar. I'm just a lawyer. So that is actually my strength, not in scholarship per se. For the first time, I had the opportunity to reflect on 20 years of practice in 2008 to start writing. So I had a gig and writing only in 2008. And I've just concluded a manuscript on some of the strategies we use in court. It's the How to Do book for lawyers practicing in Sharia courts. The American Bar Association has accepted to publish it, and so this is the state I am right now with my writing. It's about 320 pages with a compendium. So I come from this country. Maybe some of you might have heard about it or read about it somewhere called Nigeria. Nigeria is one of the 53 countries in the continent of Africa. It's the largest in terms of population. It has 150 million people. It's vast and very diverse. So we have the south and we have the north in the country. In the southern Nigeria, there is no Sharia, and I'm going to address Sharia. In the northern Nigeria, there is Sharia, okay? We have at least 4 legal systems. And I'm going to only focus a sort of on the Sharia legal system, the one that I have been in court practicing. There are about 80 million Muslims in Nigeria. So if you put the Middle East together minus Iran, you will have maybe more Muslims in Nigeria than you have in the Middle East. Nigeria, of course, is not the largest population of Islam in the world. Indonesia is. And I think we are either the fifth or the sixth. I was looking at the statistics. So there is a huge population of Muslims in the north. We were a British colony, and we got independence in 1960. Now, before independence, our leaders in the north didn't want to have the same penal code system, the same code for crime with the south. So they went on a voyage to India, which was a former British colony that they left, and they have put a law together called the Penal Code. So our leaders from the north went to India, to Pakistan, to Sudan. Coming back to Nigeria, they started a penal code, which is called Northern Nigeria Penal Code. Now the Sharia, 80 to 90% of what is contained in today's Sharia Penal Code law is from this document that used to be the Northern Nigerian Penal Code. The Northern Nigerian Penal Code was a code that we have had in the country since 1960, after independence. It has operated somehow on a very okay basis, because there have been judgment and conviction and just went on well. However, we have had a stretch of military regime. And in 1999, there was a handover of a military to a civilian governance. One of the governors who was contesting for an election that year came from a state called Zamfara, Z-A-M-F-A-R-A. And he contested on the fact that if you elect me as governor, I will give you Sharia. And that is how it started. So it was a campaign promise delivered. When he was elected and sworn in on the 29th of May, 1999, on the 27th of October, 1999, he launched Sharia. And the biggest crowd came from the Middle East, especially Saudi Arabia. It was launched, and that is the beginning of the current Sharia. And what they did was, like I said, take the former penal court law of Northern Nigeria and introduce basically five new offenses and maybe five new punishments. And I'll mention the offenses. The offenses include, if you drink alcohol, you will be publicly flogged, 100 stripes. If you steal, you will have your limbs amputated. If you commit adultery, they call it zina, Z-A-I-N-A, adultery. If you are married or divorced or have any semblance of marriage, you will be stoned to death. If you are not married at all, you will be flogged 100 times publicly. Now, zina is defined as having sexual intercourse with a person that is not your husband. So it presumes it's a man and a woman. And so when you have sexual intercourse between those two parties and with a person that is not your husband, then you commit zina. But if you are not married and you are pregnant without a husband, you commit zina, but the punishment is 100 flogging. So that is the provision of the law. The fourth one that was introduced is the an eye for an eye concept. So you, whatever offense you commit, you will be punished the way that offense is committed, it was introduced. And the fifth one had to do with the apostasy. You cannot change your religion. So these are the five new offenses and five new punishments that came into being in the year 2000, because it was announced in October, but in 2000 the laws came into being. Now Zamfara started it, less than a year after, 11 more states added up. So we have 12 states out of the 36 states in Northern Nigeria, out of the 36 states in Nigeria, 19 of the states of the 36 are in the north geographically, and 12 out of these 19 are practicing Sharia. I hope I didn't complicate the matter. We have 36 states, 19 geographically are in the north, 12 out of these 19 states have Sharia. Okay, so that is the concept in the bigger picture. Now, how did I come into this? Like I said, I was a prosecutor, I left, I started a private practice. Let me also mention at this point that I am from the north. I was born and raised a Muslim. I became educated by accident, and I became a lawyer by accident. At the age 10, I was given out of marriage. And so this is my constituency in a way. This is what I know. Yeah, this is where I grew up. And maybe at the end I'll try to explain to you how I work within the Sharia. And this is because I came from the same within. And I think the best way to get solution to some of these difficulties is how to get resolved from within. And I'll give you examples. So this is the beginning of sort of my career as a lawyer practicing in Sharia court. It was in 2000, I got a phone call from an NGO in Lagos called Baobab. They are trying to find lawyers that are female from the north, and we are very few in private practice. They were trying to look for five, they couldn't get five. They tried four, they couldn't get four. They tried three, they couldn't get three. And finally, maybe they got me, and maybe one or two others. The other person I knew for sure was the wife of the Chief Justice of Nigeria. And for a conflict of interest, and she didn't want to really get muggy into some of the things, she said she's not going to do it. So I was left alone to put up a legal team. And actually, that is how I started the Sharia cases. So it was a case of Baria. Baria was 13 years old. We put up a team. Now, it's very important to understand that it's not about a single case. It's not about a lawyer skill. It's much more beyond that. We are not fighting the case to win the case and for her to go back to her community to be stoned or to be flogged. No. So what do we do? The strategy is how do we win the hearts and minds of the villagers as we move along. And if you want to know more about it, we can talk about it. It's very important that it's not about a single case, but that the person can go back and she can live in a community. And that was our ultimate objective. So we started those cases of Baria between 2000 to 2008 when I came to Radcliffe, and I'm still doing the cases because I was back in Nigeria in January this year for one or two cases. I've handled 157 cases. Now, I do these cases pro bono. Nobody gives me a single dime. And this is because of two reasons. One, the clients are so poor, they can't afford to pay me. But most importantly, it's because I have been accused of taking money from the West to destroy Islam or to destroy Sharia. And if I want to hold my shoulders high and to work and to do these cases, I can't afford to take a dime. I can't. So if we cannot make it to court by driving our cars, we take a public transport. Remember, some of these places are maybe 12 hours away from where I live. That's in the deep villages, some of them in the desert. If we cannot get there by public transport, we get there public transport, we cannot move further with a car, we drop the car, we take a horse if we can find one. If we cannot find one, we use donkeys or horses. In the desert, when it is really tough and difficult, we use camel. So this is our route to do our cases. Generally speaking, nobody come to us and brief us. We look for the cases and go and see how we can help. Remember that this thing started in 2000. And shortly before that, 2000, there was an Attorney General of the State of Katsina, the same where Amina Lawal was convicted, that gave an order during one of the military regime that women that are not married in the service of the government of Katsina should either get married or leave the service of the state government. So it wasn't too far away from 2000 when they started. And the point I'm making here is if we don't fight those cases of this stoning and amputation and flogging, it may be our turn and nobody will be there to fight for us. So we are fighting actually for us indirectly by fighting those cases. So wherever they are, we go look for them. Most of the cases we found them in the prison, few of them were sent to us by NGOs. So this is the part of the cases. So let me speak to one case specifically and I should open it up for discussion. The case I will speak to is maybe the one that you know about, which is the case of Amina Lawal. Amina Lawal was convicted on two count charge, that she was pregnant and she has no husband, and she had a baby, of course without a husband, and she confessed. So confession and pregnancy out of wedlock. Now, she had no lawyer, just like in all the other cases that I have been part of, they do not have lawyers at trial. But among my 157 cases, four words I will tell you that cut across all of them. They are powerless. All of them are powerless. All of them are poor. All of them are voiceless. And none of them can read or write. They are illiterate. So this is what unites almost all my clients. And this is what I'm looking for before I take up a case. And that is what I would try to do, is how can we give voice to these voiceless people? So when we came into Amina's case, she has already been tried and convicted to die on the 25th of September 2002. We came into the matter in 2001. We filed the first appeal to Huntua. We filed 12 grounds, basically issues of law, facts, procedure, and technicalities. We failed on all the 15 grounds. We failed woefully. The judge did not even make a single pronouncement on any of these issues that we raised before him. So the case was appealed. In fact, they are not him, it's a panel of four judges at the Huntua court. Then we appealed the case from this panel of judges to the Sharia Appeal Court in Katsina, which is the last court in the state. Now, there's a constitutional issue. If you want to, I will speak to that, because we do have a constitution. But the last court we can appeal to Sharia cases is only on the state level. Beyond that, we cannot go further because of the constitutional restraint we have. So we took the case to the Sharia Appeal Court in Katsina, and we won, basically on technical ground, and I could speak to that in Q&A. And so that was the case of Amina. But let me mention by passing some of the bigger picture issues that I saw in these cases. Six of them I'll mention. I saw issues of supremacy of law. Which law is supreme? Are we really practicing constitutional law, constitutional government, or federal government? Or are we not? In this case, is it Sharia that is supreme, or the Constitution of Nigeria is supreme? And then we have to rely on maybe Chapter 1 of that Constitution that says something like, any law that is inconsistent with the Nigerian Constitution, to the extent of that inconsistency, that law, whichever law it is, shall be null and void. That is what the Section 1 says. I didn't say it's the Constitution of Nigeria. So it may mean that Sharia, to the extent that is inconsistent with that section of the Constitution, it will be null and void. It has not been decided upon by the Supreme Court yet, and they have that task to interpret that section of the law. But of course, the people that wanted Sharia say, you know what, under the same Constitution, we have Section 4 that says states can make laws for good governance, for peace, and for order of their states. You know, our people want Sharia, and we wanted, because they wanted Sharia, we are elected by them, we give them Sharia. So they use the same constitution to say we have a right to have Sharia. Under Section 38 of the same constitution, there's a freedom of religion. And they say under that section, we also have a right to have Sharia. So this is how it went, the argument for and against. Section 2277 of the same constitution is talking about the extent at which Sharia can be applied in court. And so it's like limited to issues of civil nature. In fact, that section itemized the issues, marriage, children, gift. It itemized them one by one, divorce. Everything was itemized in that section. So it was specific to civil matters. But anyway, so this is an argument. We can talk more about the constitutional issue. Well, supremacy of law, which law is supreme? The second thing I wanted to mention is the separation of powers. When we started those cases, I remember in the case of Baria, and there's a lot of international attention in that case, and the governor was saying, who want to rule my state? And I will talk about the media if you want to hear about it. He said, is the media coming to control my state, or I will control my state myself as a governor? And for that reason, he decided not only to be executive in terms of executive. We have three arms of government. We have the judiciary, we have the legislators, we have the executive. But he decided also to like sort of double in, and he made it very clear in the issues of the court. So of course, we couldn't get any appeal in various cases, because when we get to an office, what is the government saying? Did the governor send a word or something? Did the office send something? So do we have separation of powers? That was an issue, a bigger picture. The third issue I want to say is the issue of certainty of law. In this, most of these 12 states, each of these 12 states that have their penal code It's separate, it's different, it's not the same. We don't have one unified Sharia penal code. Each of the 12 states that have announced Sharia have their own Sharia penal code law. And each of these penal code laws says something like, if a judge is judging a case and he cannot find an answer, he can make up whatever judgment he wants to give. Section 2 of number state. Do we have certainty of law? Do we have separation and of state and religion in our country? Is there any? Do we have respect for fundamental human rights of an individual? If in 2010 or 11 we will have a woman sentenced to die by stoning, is that not torture? Is that not degrading? Do we have independence of the judiciary? So these are the bigger picture issue I want to draw. But let me say briefly about the strategy, and I'm looking at the time, I just want to stop talking. We have many strategies that we put in place, but I will mention them also by passing. If you want me to speak to any of the strategies, I'm happy to speak to them. Number one strategy is for us to understand the dynamic of the new law. What is this new Sharia that we never had before now? What is this issue of stoning? How do we understand these dynamics? How do we understand the dynamics of the mullahs? But beyond that, how do we understand the dynamic of today, our value system, our culture? Today, 23rd of March 2011, a woman is not accepted to be pregnant without a husband in my society today. And how do we understand those dynamics? But beyond understanding the dynamic is how do we walk within those dynamics. And that is where our strength is, how to walk within those difficult dynamics. Dynamic of the mullahs, very different. The second strategy is how do you pay attention to details? What are the details? We came out of court one time, somebody was screaming from that other side, you Jews of Islam. Oh, Yahuda, that is a big accusation. But not only paying attention to this detail that you know is around you, the third strategy is how do you become focused and stay focused? Especially with the case of Amina Lawal, that you have the entire media, the global media was in Nigeria because they wanted to cover the Miss Beauty pageant. If you remember, that was the year we were hosting the beauty pageant, the global beauty pageant. And that was when they wanted to cover it with their press. So the entire global press was there. By our professional ethics, I saw it a little bit different in this year, beautiful country. We do not speak to cases when it is before a judge. When you do that, it's a contempt. So we cannot address any press on any issue whatsoever unless we argue our cases in court. So when they have their microphone and their cameras, how do you still stay focused and realize that you have a professional ethic to hold on to? How do you do that? How do you remain focused? Strategy number four is how do you become firm? What are the principles of law? Which law are we talking about? What law? How do you become firm in those principles? But on the other hand, how do you become flexible with the society you are dealing with? How do you become flexible within the culture? How do you become a psychologist? You become a mother, you become a sister, you are no longer a lawyer. How do you become flexible? Strategy number six is how do you plan a defense? And I always say it's sort of a four strategy plan. So four plan in the strategy. How do you have a plan A? As a prosecutor, as I mentioned to you earlier on, it's easy for me to look at the case from the prosecution perspective. Prepare the case as if I'm prosecuting the case before I start preparing my case as a defense lawyer. That is strategy number B. That's plan number B. Prepare the case for the prosecutor for me. Plan A. Plan B, prepare my case. Plan C, just in case my argument, whatever I look at from the prosecution side had failed me in court, what will I do? And I go back to what I call the rhythm prose. So I'll introduce sentiment in the case. One of the sentiments I'll introduce, either a contradiction or some intention in the court is, Mr. Judge, what do you think if this is your daughter, how will you look at this? If it is your sister, how will you say? So you bring in some other sentiments to cover up where you cannot. Mm-hmm. The most important strategy for some of us that are always under death threat is how do you plan an exit? Exit to come, exit to go. The last thing I want to mention is, as a lawyer, for me, the most important strategy is to know the law. And I say to law students, you need to not only know it, if you can eat it, if you can digest it, and then bring it out. But you just have to know the law. You have to know beyond the law, if you can, to be able to represent a client properly. But let me end up with this story of how do you work with it. And I think I should stop in a moment. So in 2002, there was a BBC reporter that accosted me and said something with his microphone. I said, yes, it's turning to that in the Quran. And my answer was simple, I don't think so. And it was in the radio. Now, next to Swahili, the most spoken language in this huge continent is Hausa, which is the language we speak, Hausa. And so it was in the BBC Hausa, and it was played not only in northern Nigeria, it's listened in Cameroon, in Ghana, in Niger, just keep going, the western coast. In Mali too. So it was played in BBC Hausa, and the mullahs decided to answer me back to the BBC Hausa. And they say I was anti-Islam, and I was anti-Sharia for making that statement. And what that means is that I should also be stoned to death. And so I had two options. To hide or to continue the cases, or better still, to go and meet with them. So I chose the option to go and meet with them. But what I did was to call the same reporter and ask him if he can introduce me to them, because I don't know them. I had their voices on the radio. And he said, that must be very foolish of you to think. You want to see them, you heard what they said, you want to see them, are you crazy? And I was like, no, I really, really want to see them. After I persisted, he said to me, I will introduce you to them, but I won't be responsible for you. And so he introduced me to them. They were so gracious, very generous, that he decided to see me. This Amen I couldn't see in months before that. In fact, they don't even want to hear the name Hawa Ibrahim at all. And for them to accept to see me was the biggest thing that would have happened to me during those times. Now, I am dressed, but I'm not properly dressed to enter the mosque at all. And I'm standing just to let you know that there is sensitivity in other issues, and I just want to stress that word, underscore sensitivity to what we do. So I am not properly dressed, so I dress from my fingers to my toes, completely covered. I went inside the mosque. There were 8 mullahs. There's a huge mosque in Abuja. Maybe we'll see 5,000 people. At the end of the mosque were 8 men, big turbans, all sitting on a chair. Halfway through the mosque was a chair. And I approached them. When I was going, I saw the chair, but I didn't go through the chair. I approached these mullahs. Getting close to them, I bent down. I knelt down, and I sat on the floor before their feet. And they echoed at the same time, you stand up, go and sit there. And I am not allowed to look at their faces because they are men. My culture doesn't allow me to look at them on the face at all. So I was looking on the floor and I said to them something like, how can I, your daughter, sit on the chair when you, my fathers, are sitting on the chair? They were quiet for some time. When they spoke, they said something like, oh, you've not forgotten your religious teaching. I said, my religious teachings. I said, you've not forgotten your culture. And I said, no, as you please. But remember, what took me to the mosque was a radio interview. I did not say a word about the radio interview. I told them I'm a foolish lawyer. I told them I'm a silly lawyer. I told them I am out there trying to do something for this woman and children. But I'm not sure I'm getting it right. And I came to them because I needed their wisdom. And I came to them because I needed their knowledge. I want them to put me on the right path. That is why I came to the monks. Did I put the act on? No. That is what I would have done anywhere because that's my culture. That's where I'm coming from. That is how the system works. It's not about me. Not at all. The cases have never been about Hawa. Not yet. So we had a very long conversation with them. And at the end of the conversation, they said two things to me. They said, we publicly not support what you're doing, but we also publicly not oppose what you're doing. That is the most important statement I could have gotten from them, because it's a huge security statement. When I went to them, I had dozens of cases. Now I'm thinking, I just mentioned to you 157 cases. Without them, I wouldn't have gone an inch. But this is my dynamic. And I choose to work within my dynamics. And it's never about us. It's about a bigger thing. About generation yet unborn. About issues that we care about. About peace and security and freedom. Thank you for that, yes.